Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. I bet you get 30, 30, I bet you get 30, I bet you get 20, 20, 20, I bet you get 20, 20, I bet you get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month, sold.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hello, I'm David Kern.
I'm Heidi White.
I'm Tim McIntosh.
And you are listening to Close Reads, a podcast for the incurable reader, on which we are answering your questions about John Kennedy Toole's A Confederacy of Dunces. This is a book that confounded some people, so we're going to have some great questions. It was also a book that left some people feeling cold, so I think we've got some questions about that. First, though, Heidi and Tim, it's Christmas week. It's Tuesday, December 21st when we're recording right now. We're recording a little earlier than normal. By the time this episode goes up, it will be, I believe, Christmas Eve, or maybe a little earlier, depending on, you know, what Logan wants to do as far as getting it ready. But Merry Christmas. And thanks for taking some time Christmas week to give the people what they want.
I'm so glad to be here to share my exuberant Christmas spirit with the world. How about you, Tim?
I'm really excited to share my exuberant Christmas spirit with the world.
The thing about you, Tim, is that's like a seven.
Full of festive feelings.
Mirth. That's about as good as it gets.
Mirth.
For Tim.
And I have.
Unless he was at my house.
And I was wearing a candy cane jumper. Isn't that what your boys get dressed up as?
I would really like to see. Yes, that's exactly. That's a direct quote. Yeah. I dress my boys up in candy cane jumpers.
Yeah.
By Heidi White.
And here's some mincemeat pie.
What even is that?
I don't know. It's one of those things that shows up like in Dickens and in like Laura Ingalls Wilder novels. Mincemeat pie.
I did. It's true. I did roast a goose a couple of years ago.
I remember that.
Awesome. It was really good.
Aren't they really kind of greasy fowls?
Not if you do it properly. So they are, there's a system to degrease the fowl. You turn it in crispy. Like, so you have to dry brine it overnight and poke holes. It's a process. It's a whole thing. And it was delicious. And I made like the best gravy, and I kept the goose fat, and I used it for a bunch of stuff over the course of the year, and it was delicious. So, you know,
what's that?
God bless us, everyone.
Everyone. My association with geese, aside from
a vast open skies and a crinked neck.
Yes. No, there's a kind of funny story around my family, as told by my mom, who is one of the gentlest, kindest, most warm-hearted people that I've ever met. And she told me the story about, I think it was the day.
Anytime you lead off a story with that, it's going to be a good one.
Oh, yeah. This is a good
She's
one.
A normally gentle person.
I feel
person.
Like she's going to turn into a badass in about 15 seconds.
That is exactly right. Yeah. That's exactly what happens. The day that her mother died. Her mother died of tuberculosis, like shortly after my grandmother and my grandfather moved in with us when I was like in, I don't know,
wow.
I was maybe 10 or something like that. So my mom drove off to this little park to be by herself. And she, you know, was having a really bad day. Her mom had just died. So she gets in the car to drive home, and there are these flock of geese that were crossing the road. And they kind of like looked up at mom's approaching car, and they were like, wah, 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 you know, and they're giving mom a hard time for like exiting the park. And mom was like, I have had enough. And she just guns it. She just guns the car right into this flock of geese and scattering them everywhere. And that was like a moment of real
catharsis
for mom. And every time I hear about
I'm so proud of her.
I am
geese
too.
Geese are mean. They're mean creatures.
They're so mean. That is exactly right. So many people don't know that about geese.
They deserve it.
They're so beautiful up in the sky. Justice was served.
Strangely, the next 4 days, we had goose for dinner.
We had goose dumplings
meals a day.
That's where I got my recipe.
I had a new feather pillow in my bed 2 days later. Well, okay. Before we get into the Q&A, I have a cue for you to A about the holidays. We've talked about
some of the
traditions, some of the traditions that Tim made fun of last week. We've talked about this in the past a little bit, but I'm curious, what are your favorite Christmas movies? I'm sure, you know, maybe over the next few nights, you might be queuing up a good holiday bit of entertainment. So I'm curious, what are the ones that you turn to every year? Tim, what about you? What do you got on that?
I'm going to make a top
He's about
a
to
top
say Die Hard.
List. Die Hard, number three. Number two, National Lampoon's Christmas Vacation. And number one, with an absolute bullet, the heartwarming tale of a man who has an encounter with an angel while standing on his suicide bridge. It's a Wonderful Life. It's a Wonderful Life, I think, is a top 10 movie, regardless of seasonal, seasonal weight. It is such a beautiful movie. And there are a couple of scenes that I will cry every time I see the scenes. The scene in the drugstore where the druggist has, like, you know, he's overwhelmed because he lost his son in the war and he puts too much of a bad chemical mixture. And when George is a kid and George knows what he's done, and so he doesn't deliver. Oh my gosh, that scene is absolutely, I don't even know how they did that scene, because like the slaps that the old man is giving, you know, young George are so violent. They're so real. And George, that young man's acting is just like, it was incredible. That's just such an incredible scene. And it pivots, you know, like the realization that George has done a really good thing is, oh, it kills me. Mm.
That is, it's fascinating to me how that movie has become a staple of Christmas, because in many ways it's actually kind of a strangely dark movie for much of it.
Yeah. Oh yeah.
And then in the end it ends positively, but most of the time it's this guy who's on the edge of despair. Mm-hmm. You know, mm-hmm. 2 hours and 25 minutes of despair.
Oh
and
yeah.
The most famous of Christmas movies.
Life on the
or
Bridge.
At least one of them. And Die Hard is definitely a Christmas movie. I get together with some friends most Sunday nights to watch various
Sunday
cinematic
streamers.
Fare of varying Sunday streamers, cinematic fare of various degrees of quality. And this last Sunday was Die Hard week, because we had to watch
was
Die Hard
really?
With the boys. Oh yeah, and on a rewatch, still holds up. Great action movie, regardless of Christmas or not. And you see, like, it's so influential on like Mission Impossible and so many things like that.
Really, really.
Heidi, what about you? Christmas movies.
So I just want to say that now we know where the full weight of Tim's Christmas sentiment is. It's on It's a Wonderful Life. So,
it is.
Yeah, the bleak of the better.
I feel closer to you right now.
It's
a
Macintosh story.
Yeah,
because you feel like I actually do.
So
have
So that
some Christmas
way
spirit.
That you feel about yes, that way you feel about It's a Wonderful Life is how I feel.
Is how
about
Heidi feels about
all
candy cane
of
rompers,
Christmas joy and mirth, including the rompers that my family wears. My top three Christmas movies. Number three, the cartoon version of How the Grinch Stole Christmas. I'm crazy about that movie. Number two is Home Alone. We love that movie. That is, it's slapstick, so maybe I do love farce, but I love that movie.
Does that one stand up, like hold up?
I don't, I think
Despite
it does,
the passing years.
But I don't know, because I don't care. Like, I'm not a film person. Right. So I am in that blessed, but totally lowbrow position of being like, I don't know if it's good, but I know what I like, you know,
how
regular people walk through the Louvre. I'm like that about movies. So that's,
oh my gosh, regular people walk through the Louvre. That's how I am with movies. Oh my gosh. Logan, can we get any like sound effects on that? People walk through the Louvre. That's how I am with movies.
I think it holds up.
I don't think we need a sound effect. But, okay, David, does it hold up?
The parenting. It does. It holds up. The parenting, though, is a real problem. Like in any generation.
It's so bad.
And especially like there's no, like the idea that it happened again in Home Alone 2, that really doesn't hold up. Just no,
you kind of
want
to call child services.
Time.
Exactly. Yeah. Like, yeah, right, DFAX yeah. didn't get a call on January 1st.
Yeah. Well, yeah. It's,
I mean, and it could never happen now because of cell phones and stuff.
Hey, by the way, I heard that Airbnb will allow you to rent the Home Alone house. It's like one of their offerings.
Oh.
Little that plug for good. Airbnb, the most recent host that. Of Close Reads.
As long as there's no tarantula in the house. Ew, I'll take the robbers, yeah. No problem. But no tarantula. Okay, and then no, I feel like the banter is really extended here. So I'm going to give you my number one with a bullet, which is The Muppet Christmas Carol. So that's, yeah.
I don't know that I've seen that in like 30 years.
Well, we watch
I'll
it
just
every
say,
year.
Michael Caine is acting the heck out of that movie.
He's such a good Scrooge.
There's no other people in it.
Wow, yeah, that's
well,
impressive.
That's true because the rest of them are Muppets. So, yeah. But like they make Gonzo into Charles Dickens and he narrates the whole story. It's and
no
his little
way.
Rat friend doesn't believe that he's really Charles Dickens. It's no so way. Great. Like it's a really, really good, it's an objectively good yeah. movie. And I think it,
yeah,
because
good,
Michael
that's
Caine.
That's a big one in our house.
Yeah. Is a really good Scrooge. So anyway, Tim, David, what are your three?
I'm going to put Die Hard on there just because it's, I love it. And I'm going to just, I, you know, I'm like Die Hard, how regular people are with the, when they walk through the Louvre. I just know what I want. I know what I like.
It's still funny. If it's funny,
Where's Mona Lisa? I want to see that funny smile.
Well, I'll tell you my favorite Christmas movie. I would say that probably It's a Wonderful Life would be two for me. It's hard because there's a bunch of the regular, just sort of classic ones that kind of are in a jumble to me. The National Lampoons and Christmas Story. And like, to me, those are all kind of one. The ones that I find myself excited to watch every year are Die Hard, It's a Wonderful Life, and then a movie that is in my top three movies, regardless. Sometimes it's my favorite, sometimes it's my second, sometimes it's my third favorite. It depends on when you ask me, but that is The Apartment, the Billy Wilder movie. Mm.
That's and such a great movie.
It takes place from right before Christmas to New Year's. And that's the movie that I make my wife watch with me. And then I end up watching it when she falls asleep. Because we have little kids and so forth. But that is the greatest holiday movie ever. And it's up there with It's a Wonderful Life. And it's just a personal.
I forgot that was a Christmas that
yeah, it takes place over the
line.
Christmas break. Yeah. Mm. Yeah.
We'll watch like this week. Now you
the
reminded
big
me of
climax
it.
Is New Year's Eve and the big end of act one is a Christmas party. So great, great movie. It's about becoming a mensch, better human being.
Hmm.
Great, wordless acting in that movie. Just fantastic.
Jack Lemmon.
Well, and like super Lemmon, snappy yeah. dialogue. That's just
yeah,
great.
Yeah. Billy Wilder was a legend. Just want to throw that out there for those of you who have not brushed up on your Billy Wilder, make that a 2022 resolution. One of the greatest filmmakers ever. Sabrina, for example.
Okay. Oh, wow.
Sabrina, The Apartment, Some Like It Hot. I mean, just an incredible canon of movies. Okay. But we are here to talk about something else. We've got a bunch of questions on Confederacy of Dunces. And I want to start with this one, which was emailed. I'm going to give some priority here in these first three questions to three people who sent us emails. This is from Elizabeth Trotman, longtime listener, Patreon supporter. Big thanks to Elizabeth for all of her support. So she says, this is probably way too long for the podcast because I have to explain the premise first. You all rejected the premise in the last episode, so I'm going out on a limb. So you don't have to answer it. But when someone says, this is probably too long for the podcast, I take that as a challenge and we're going to try it. So she says this. This is her premise. Every character has some kind of redemptive arc. So I'm going to read her ideas for what each of these redemptive arcs are and then her question, and then we'll get some feedback. Okay. So Mrs. Riley, she suggests, asserts her independence from her son and tells him the truth. You learned everything but how to be a human being. Gus Levy works out his parental issues with his father after seeing the Ignatius story. Miss Trixie gets to retire and gets a ham because Ignatius explains her motives to Gus. Officer Mancuso gets elevated within the police force due to having a
redemption like a ham.
Ignatius on. We need to get that one a call out there. We need to get a hashtag on that. Hashtag redemption ham. I mean, that's why we eat ham at Christmas anyway, right? Jones gets an award from Levy Pants and a job over the minimum wage, all because Ignatius came to the bar. The dancer girl, Elizabeth says she forgets her name, gets a big break because of the scene caused by Ignatius. Lana Lee gets her just desserts because of Ignatius. Myrna gets to save someone because of Ignatius. She has saving air quotes. And Ignatius leaves his childhood home in New Orleans, harkening back to the beginning of the book when he was afraid to go anywhere at all. With a movement towards being able to exist in the world, he actually physically touches a woman with a movement towards intimacy or genuine connection with another human being. So, Elizabeth summarizes, it seems to me that Ignatius is the hero who makes everyone's life better in the end, even though the way he does it is not by teaching them about medieval philosophy. So, her question, if you accept the premise, what might the author want us to take from the dissonance between how Ignatius wants to help people by teaching them philosophy and how he does help people by being sort of crazy?
That's an interesting question. Yeah, there's a real dissonance there.
So I think even if we don't totally accept the premise, I think she's in some of those, she seems to be being a little tongue in cheek about redemption, but it, you know, it does seem like there is movement in a lot of these characters in a way that isn't always readily obvious. And her summary is pretty apt, I think, overall. Tim, go ahead.
I was going to say, I think you're right. Movement happens with every character. It seems like the way that we've been using redemption is sort of like an internal turn toward the good and away from the bad. And I think Mrs. Riley does that. And a couple of the other characters do that. A lot of the movement though is sort of like Jones is just rewarded, you know, but I don't know that like Jones like has like a big turn. Anyway, that might be a quibble. Elizabeth would be like, Tim, get over it. I'm just, you know, pointing out that it's movement. And I think she's exactly right. I think there's movement in all those characters. The interesting question, which I'm going to let Heidi answer because I just feel like she's got something on this, is that incongruity between what Ignatius J. Riley teaches and kind of like what he ends up getting from people because he's kind of crazy. Heidi, aren't you glad that I just kind of punted that
question over to you? Thanks so much for punting it over. I'm going to grab that.
I don't have an answer myself.
I'm going to pick up that punt and I'm going to head the other way and take it into the end zone and score a touchdown. Nice. See, that was a sports ball.
Sports ball?
Some of that was true.
Yeah. I really like, will you remind me the listener's name, David?
Elizabeth.
This is a really, Elizabeth, this is a really, really great comment. I really love it. I think it depends on whether you interpret this as a comedy or a tragedy. So David made the case last week, and I think it was pretty compelling, that it's a kind of a dark, a funny tragedy. And so you could look at it as like a dark comedy or a funny tragedy. If you look at it like a dark comedy, I think Elizabeth, you're exactly right. Ignatius looks like an agent of chaos, but he actually brings some sort of order through his clumsy and failed interventions. He's just blind to the good he's doing in the world. And then you can kind of look at everything he's saying as absolutely true, which I definitely do. Like the modern world needs theology and geometry. I couldn't agree more. Right. And he's actually coming in and bringing and imposing some kind of theology and geometry upon the world. I mean, Tim even just used the word congruent, which is a geometrical term, yeah. Right? So I think that that is one way to look at it. Another way that also works is if you see it as a funny tragedy, then what you see is a potential for redemption through this accidental intervention from Ignatius, but everybody misses it. Nobody's eyes are open enough to see it. And And then it still ends with this kind of tragic inversion of the hero running off into the sunset. But we know he's just going to repeat this pattern and wreck it all again. Yeah. Right. And so it's one or the other, really not both. And I think that that is the up to the reader to be able to see it one way or the other.
I think that's partly because of like, you kind of want to look at it from a meta perspective. Are those changes like that these characters end up making or having thrust upon them? Are they like absolutely necessary within the world of the story? Or are they something that our author as the creator of the world makes happen to create an order out of Ignatius's chaos? Like, you know, that's what all authors do. To some degree,
theology and geometry. Yes.
But there is also an extent, like, is he just making it? Like, is it you could quibble or you could suggest that those things, that those changes were not consistent with what had been going on. Like, there's a little bit of a hand of God scenario there. Like, what's the phrase when it just kind of feels like some of those changes come out of nowhere?
Right.
The deus ex machina.
The deus ex machina. Yeah, like the author's just basically saying, I want there to be the illusion at least of some sort of positive movement. So he just makes it happen. And as opposed to it naturally organically happening through the course of the action of the story. Like what that's one of the interesting things to me about storytelling is the way the greatest authors make the thing they would feel like should happen seem organic. Like the story, it's the only thing that could have happened. And when I read this book, as much as I love it, sometimes I wonder if, like, I don't feel like the things that happen to the characters in the end are the only things that could have happened to them. Mm. I don't know if that makes sense. Just I'm thinking about it on a meta sort of choice level for the storyteller, which is sort of annoying to do and pedantic, but I know no other way.
Welcome to David Kern.
I know
no other way.
Why are we doing this?
I remember David reading an essay that argued that comedy was the kind of like the most theological robust genre of films and books. And I approached that title with some skepticism because, as we all know, drama, which suits my nature, particularly dark, sad drama, is the most theological robust. Yeah, especially is the most theological robust genre. So I approached with hesitation and skepticism. But by the time I got to the end, I was like, oh, this is a really good case. And the case, I think, actually really fits Confederacy of Dunces here. So what Ignatius J. Reilly advocates for is, yeah, a return to theology and geometry, but everything that he does, buffoon-like, clown-like, ends up kind of backfiring. And yet at the end, there is positive movement for every character. And so what you're left to assume, or what you're left to kind of extract from that, is that there is some hidden force that brings about positive movement for all of the characters, just as theology overtly asserts. And so no character within the realm of the story is bringing about these good things. It's some hidden force outside of the realm of the characters that's bringing about good ends for them. And so you can make the case that, like, the theology that Ignatius J. Reilly is advocating for and trying to teach, well, it's not really, he fails in his attempt to teach it, but in this mystical
way.
It's
working on the characters.
It's working on the characters.
Yeah. It's the energy that drives the world.
What is the line
the
from Hamlet?
Of grace.
There is a there's a power that shapes our ends, rough hew them how we will, something like that. Like that's in a lot of ways the story of this novel.
Right. Well, and it's like Bride's Head, right? In Bride's Head, it's the twitch upon the string. Mm-hmm. Like there is an action of grace within the story. I think for me, one thing I've been wrestling with in real life, and now I'm kind of applying it to this book, and it makes me like the book a little better, is it necessary for the eyes of our hearts the eyes of our soul to actually be open to see the action of grace in order for the action of grace to actually have a real effect on our souls, a redemptive effect on our souls. And if it is necessary for the characters to be aware of that in real life, people in real life or in a story, I think this is a tragedy.
Because they don't see it.
Because they don't see it. I don't see any evidence that anybody sees it in the story. However, and that actually I wrestle with just in general about life. Like I want, like, can you not see the action of grace in your life? And if you can't, does that mean, you know, if a tree falls in a forest and nobody's around to hear it, it doesn't make a sound, right? The action of grace to me, I wrestle on a very personal level of with that question about grace. Like, is it necessary for us to be aware of it, for us to have a real effect upon the arc of redemption in the human life? Or is it all happening whether we see it or not and moving us toward salvation? And that is something I personally am tormented by. And so looking at that in the novel kind of gives me a different perspective on it. So I'm grateful for Elizabeth's question.
At the risk of it being too abrupt, I do want to move on to some other questions, though. So this one comes from Rosemary, also via email. By the way, if you ever want to email a question in, it's david@goldberrybooks.com. So Rosemary says, I'm not on social media, so if this has already been discussed, you can disregard the question, but I'm wondering if A Confederacy of Dunces is comparable to any other book. It seems to stand in a genre and possibly a universe of its own. Usually when I'm reading, either the book or the author reminds me of another. But this one, I think the closest I came for sheer ridiculousness was The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy. And some of the stereotypical but memorable characters remind me of Herman Wouk's New York Jewish characters in his books. Anyway, just wondering if you all have any insights on this. What would you compare this book to, Heidi?
I was just about to say, I'm like the worst person to answer this question because I don't... Like, this isn't my favorite genre. I don't read a lot of like farce and comedy books. So when I encounter them, I like them. So, I mean, we've already talked about Woodhouse. We've talked a bit about Don Quixote and the picaresque genre. And so I think that those are comparable. I know for a fact that there's a lot of, I know that there are books like this that I have not read. And I don't know where this falls in, where Confederacy of Dunces falls kind of in that hierarchy, if it's considered a classic and that kind of farcical comedy with like an unlikable character at the center. I know that's pretty popular in modern books. So I'm going to pass it off to the two of you, especially to David, because I don't know if anybody knows this, but David owns a bookstore. So he might have access to this more than any of us. But Tim, you seem like you like books like this.
What is that called? That's called like damning with faint
praise.
But it's not praise exactly. It's like damning with faint associative powers. Like, Tim, you like kind of bad books like this, don't you? Can you speak into this question?
You like gross books?
Yeah.
With terrible people in them. So
Hamlet.
You named the first two that sprang to my mind, Woodhouse and Don Quixote. I would maybe add Chaucer. There are just enough allusions.
That's a good point.
Chaucer. Yeah. But I don't think it really fits Chaucer's narrative very neatly. I think the book that it most resembles is probably Cervantes' Don Quixote.
I think a couple other ones that you could that often get mentioned in the same breath are Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy is actually a really good reference or mention. Also, Kurt Vonnegut gets mentioned in the same. Huh. It's kind of being a similar approach. So does Walker Percy.
Walker Percy, which
we talked about a little bit, and of course Percy was the one that sort of discovered this book. Before we started this, I actually was kind of looking up this question, kind of seeing like when people talk about this book, what do they talk about? And one of the authors that gets talked about a lot in connection to John Kennedy Toole somehow is David Sedaris.
Really?
Who is a comic nonfiction writer.
I have read him and I like him. He makes me laugh out loud.
Huh.
His books get progressively, but those first few were hilarious.
Exactly. He actually has a new book out called something like a Chronicle of Snackery or something, and it's like 20 years of his journals.
Huh. Oh, that just sounds came up this funny. Year. Me Talk Pretty One Day made me laugh harder than any book I've ever read in my life.
Really?
Yes. I loved that book.
Okay. Next question. This comes from Danielle, also via email. She says, coming at you with a general request for a Confederacy of Dunces Q&A, please get back on your what's the deal with train of thought. In the episode where you articulated this line of thinking, I got really excited and thought you guys were going to get into some of the more bizarre and seemingly random characters and plot points, but you didn't necessarily after all. So if I had to pick one person or thing from the list, I would pick Jones. What's the deal with Jones? Said in our best Seinfeld voice. That's just me adding that. But what's the deal with Jones? I'd really like to hear your take on that. And then we got some questions about that on the Facebook group too. So I think we should make sure we address what's the deal with Jones?
Mm-hmm. Hooah.
Tim?
I don't know what the deal with Jones is. Jones is like, there's maybe three or four characters that like play a similar kind of role. They're hilarious. They're fun to listen to. And they're really sharply defined. Like whenever Jones walks on the stage, like his voice is immediately recognizable and his agenda is immediately recognizable. And I think he's really well drawn in that way. But like, what role does he play? The best that I can come up with is he is a vibrant picture of a New Orleans style character. He just belongs in the setting because he's such a prominent fixture in New Orleans. That's the best that I can do.
I do think that the question of race is also something that Jones represents, because for Ignatius, it's like this, it's something he can sort of like be fake, a fake warrior over, like a fake social justice warrior.
Yeah.
And so you have this character who is in like very dire situations, right? Like who can't, like a lot of the things that Jones says about his situation are either true or kind of heartbreaking if you take them at face value and don't, and you just kind of strip away the way he says things and the kind of weirdness of the character. And so it makes him, it makes him a character who is not actually in a very different place in life than Ignatius in terms of the status, other than the fact that he is black.
Yeah.
And so Ignatius can both look down on him and think of himself as better than him and as somebody that he is going to kind of go to bat for, so to speak, and yet also never actually do anything for. Mm-hmm. And so I think that that's a big part of this book, is like the idea that of people having best intentions that only serve them, their own sense of who they are themselves. Mm. And it goes back to my old, this is just people on Twitter thing. But I do think that's an important part of it. I think that's a great answer, David.
I think that's better than a
New Orleans color. No, I think the New Orleans color is a really important factor with a lot of these characters. And he, you know, I think he is doing a satire, a send up of that culture, having lived there in a way that you couldn't do if you didn't live there.
Yeah.
But I also think that there is a sort of like a social justice, you know, an ironic social justice element to this that allows him, Kennedy Toole, to make some points about people being dumb. Mm. Heidi, do you want to add anything?
Yeah, I think also, so I, when I was younger, I tried to learn how to use a compass and I couldn't figure it out because I have a terrible sense of direction. I'm good at like three things and everything else. I'm like really good at like three things and then everything else.
One of the things you're good at is making a point with a very interesting story or anecdote at the beginning of it.
Learning how to use a compass. And I'm like, okay, so I'm going to learn how to use a compass. And then like, I totally failed.
Number two.
Yes, I could do that. So I have a terrible sense of direction and I'd always end up like wandering around. But when I moved to Colorado, then I had like a fixed point because the mountains are always in the west, right? So now I can always find my way places. But I think that what we have in all of these main plots and subplots in this novel is somebody trying to stumble around without the mountains as their guide, right? Who's actually trying to find their way towards some kind of goodness. I think we see that with Mr. Levy. I think we see that with Jones. I think we see that with Ignatius's mom. Somebody in each of these like kind of circles in the story who is actually trying to do the right thing and bring some kind of order to the chaos, and but doesn't have the mountains on the west, right? And I think Jones is that character in that particular subplot. And he's also like exactly what both of you said. He's a local character, firmly grounded within the community, who has a role within the hierarchy, which is very medieval, right? And kind of owns it, but also resists it at the same time, which makes him interesting. So we have this like American chaotic medievalism, and Jones is the character within that storyline who represents something local, but also represents something universal, who's kind of trying to stumble towards goodness, but doesn't have that fixed point.
Interesting.
I feel like in a different episode, we could discuss that for, well, we could discuss this whole thing for an extended period of time.
Agreed. It's a really complex novel, and there's a lot that we didn't get to in our conversation because we were wrestling with kind of certain things that we were drawn to. But I mean, all these questions are good because they open that up for us to think about and for the listeners to think about.
Again, it goes back to my thing about how it's not perfect, but it is compelling because it raises these questions. Sometimes I feel like in my reading life, I feel like I need to either, I'm either reading because I feel like something is some great classic that I need to cover, you know, whether it's a reread of Twelfth Night, which I just actually happen to love, or, you know, War and Peace, or, you know, just something that I haven't read in a long time or I've never read and I need to check it off the box because I can't call myself a good reader if I haven't. And then there's just the kind of the pure pleasure, the Agatha Christie novel, the spy novel that's like disconnect from reality and, you know, just kind of, I don't know, what's the word? Veg out for a while. I don't know. But then there's books like this where we know that they're not necessarily like, this is not a capital B great book, but it's so weirdly fascinating that it has remained in sort of the public eye in curious readers for so long that I just want to read it and talk about it because it's an interesting book to read and talk about for the sake of reading and talking about it, you know, even if we can agree, well, it's probably 200 years. I don't know that people are going to be reading this anymore very often, although they might, but, and it's kind of like a weird middle ground in terms of my reading life that I've been increasingly more interested in books that aren't capital G, capital B. They're also not, you know, waste an hour to feel better about life. but they're like somewhere in between and the weirdness is what makes them compelling. So anyway, that's just a slight little diatribe there.
Agreed.
Okay. Well, Jennifer wants to know, asks this on Facebook, how long do you think it'll take Myrna to kick Ignatius out of her car? Will they make it to New York? Tim, what do you think about that?
I think they make it to New York. I think if they move in together, they're doomed. Like, absolutely doomed.
What do you think, Heidi?
Yeah, I mean, it's a cycle, right? This is one of those dysfunctional, toxic relationships that takes 15 years before somebody, like, they'll break up and then somebody will move out and then she'll decide she wants to save him again and he's a narcissist. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And so it'll just keep going around and around and around.
But what if Ignatius changes? What if he changes?
So like, this is the same question. This is what's going to keep Myrna in the relationship for the next 15 years, Tim. Yeah,
exactly.
You're like, you're such an enabler, Tim. You're enabling Ignatius J. Reilly. And it's true. I probably am because I love him. But yeah, if like, hold up. If, you know, like my sister or one of my nieces wanted to get together with Ignatius J. Reilly, hold up. Stop.
What? I mean,
let's
what
come
makes
to your
him,
senses.
Right. What makes him change? Right. Like this is every... Well, she's just as toxic as he is. She's awful. So there, this.
Yeah, if that's your niece or your sister, you've got some other things to work on.
Yeah, right.
So, okay, Susanna asks, how does the story of Ignatius' dog, as told by their neighbor, Miss Annie, shed light on the state of his character? Sarah then also mentions that the dog is also mentioned at the beginning. And she says, I think the dog's grave was also referenced in the middle of the book. So it seems like there is definitely an emphasis on this dog and its impact on Ignatius. So Heidi, what do you think about this?
Yeah, I mean, it's profound psychological insight. Every terrible person was once a hurt child. That's the way it is. Right. So that's... He's a terrible person. And one of the reasons he's a terrible person now is because he had like these deep childhood wounds. John Kennedy Toole is giving us every opportunity within this story to like humanize Ignatius and wrestle with the fact that he's like this wounded little boy. He lost his dad. He was something creepy happened with his college professor. He lost his dog and the church didn't acknowledge the wound. Like his mom enabled him. Like, I mean, it really is like he, John Kennedy Toole had, you know, he looked up what does it take to create a narcissist and what kind of childhood wounds are necessary to create this long personality disorder that never gets resolved because narcissists don't get better, Tim. And so then he invented a sad tragedy from
the professional. The child. Professional steps up there and Heidi. She's like, he's not getting better, Tim.
Walk away.
And listener, you need to break up with your boyfriend.
Right, so, right.
Yeah, so I think it's really sad. It's a real grief and a sadness. And there was a time he could have taken a better path.
So there's a question from Sarah about, is the absence of Ignatius' father significant? And if so, why doesn't the book put more emphasis on it? And she mentions how in Peace Like a River, there's an absent mother, but we do get just enough to understand the impact of her actions and her absence. So it's not directly addressed in this book. Heidi, looking at this from both a narrative perspective and then also a story, a professional perspective, what do you think about this? Tim wants to say something too, so I'll let you
know. I was just going to say, and as a professional psychologist.
Yeah, exactly. There's a couple questions about things that you professionally know more than Tim and I do.
So this book is incredibly psychologically insightful and consistent. I think that's one of the best parts of the book. But that's also how I read. And so that is, like, I liked that. I think it's, and it's very, very Freudian. Like if you were to, which I think as, I think it was David that you said a couple of episodes ago, how it's a little tongue in cheek as it approaches the Freudian interpretation. It's exaggerated and obvious for anybody who knows Freudian psychology, the hot dog cart and the flowers and all that, right? Like it's very, very exaggerated. But it's consistent all the way throughout. And then there's a lot of subtleties that are thrown in too, like the dog or just the comment about how he was beloved by the nuns at his Catholic school and coddled by his mother. So obviously we have like a bit of an Oedipal thing happening here. And then the college professor, which creates a homoerotic element that definitely plays out in the story. So there's all of these really interesting layers of Freudian and psychological interpretation. Of course, a boy who loses his father and is coddled by his mother. There are consequences to that within the character of a man. And again, that's just classic psychoanalysis. And he works that into the story, both in big exaggerated ways. And also I think in kind of subtle ways that add to some pathos, not just satire.
There's a question about whether, can we all agree, this is from Andy, can we all agree Ignatius suffers from antisocial personality disorder? And he needs a good mixture of antipsychotics and antidepressants and mood stabilizers with a healthy dose of therapy. Oh, and should we feel guilty for laughing at him? We don't need to talk about this too much. But what do you guys think about the idea of like, should we feel guilty for laughing at him? He uses a couple, Andy uses a couple emojis here to kind of say like, maybe he's being a little tongue in cheek. But I was thinking about this when reading, because we talk a lot about empathy and we did quite a bit in this book. And he is hilarious, but also the hilarity often stems from some really brokenness inside of him. So how do you think the book wants us to approach that? Like, are we supposed to just laugh at him without feeling guilty, or is it asking us to consider some things about ourselves and how we think about that? Like, Tim, how do you approach that?
I have a hard time saying, I don't know what to think about this, because the question, it seems like there's sort of like there's a wink behind this question, and I don't know how to interpret that wink. You know, like, we don't really, we don't like, this is what the modern world does. The modern world kind of like sands off out, you know, like salient characters by using pharmaceutical drugs. If that's what the wink behind the question means, then okay, yeah, maybe I can like, but I have a hard time answering this question because I don't know what the intention is behind it. I'm employing a hermeneutic of suspicion right now, which is probably like a bad move to do with your listeners, but I just don't know what to do with this question. Do you have a better idea, Heidi?
So guilt and compassion are two different emotions, and you don't need to feel guilt in order to have compassion. And so I think that that in approaching Ignatius, it's very clear, and we've been very clear on the show, we've said multiple times in every episode that there is a hilarity to this character and this storyline, and there's also a grief and a sadness and a brokenness in it. And they both exist at the same time. I personally think that's a much healthier and more human approach than guilt. To say this is funny on the one hand and also deeply sad on the other. And so I can feel compassion, and I can also feel the level of ridiculousness that this person and his dysfunction and toxicity brings into the world. So to be able to chuckle at something and laugh at it and also say, wow, this is a really broken person, and I hope that they will recover and become better and choose the right path, and I feel the grief of the brokenness of their life. To me, that is a much, much more human and true response than saying that in order to feel compassionate, I have to feel guilty and keep myself from any kind of true and proper response to their dysfunction and brokenness. Mm. So I'm absolutely willing to laugh at it, especially since this book is funny. Mm-hmm. So I don't need to feel guilty about thinking something is funny that is funny objectively. Yeah. And guilt doesn't heal. Guilt is not a healing emotion. Compassion is, right? And repentance, those are healing to the soul. Guilt isn't. Guilt just brings disorder. And this is a book that laughs at disorder and points it out and asks us to look at it and to figure out a response, wrestle through a complex response. Guilt is a pretty easy response. So I do kind of reject the premise of the question, but I also hear the wink and the irony behind it and say, I think he's more of a narcissist than antisocial, because antisocial people actually want to hurt and wound and create chaos. And he is wanting to be worshipped and adored. And that's a narcissistic, that's a narcissistic personality disorder, not an antisocial one. But I get the point. And I hear the wink behind it, and I'm saying, yeah, I know, right? Like, that's the modern world wants to make everybody feel guilty, and I think that that's too easy.
Okay, moving on. We've got a question here from Roland. I'm fascinated by Gus Levy. Just curious as to your thoughts. We've got a few questions about Gus. Is it possible that Gus is a surrogate type character for Tool? I know I've read or heard Ignatius was based on a professor acquaintance of Tool's, and I think there might be similarities between Gus and Tool. He's a guy that pushed around by the ladies in his life who depend on him for their livelihoods. There's some parallels between Tool and his mother. He seems a bit like the unwilling straight man throughout the book. And in the end, his redemption comes via the actions of Ignatius. And he does say redemption might be a strong word. So let's talk about Gus in general and Mr. Levy. We didn't really get a chance to touch on that too much. Tim, what do you think of the idea of Gus being the sort of unwilling straight man throughout the book, almost as perhaps even, Roland didn't say this, but maybe almost like a foil in some ways for Ignatius?
I don't think he's prominent enough to really be a foil anywhere other than in his storyline. And I asked myself many times when I was reading the exchanges between he and Mrs. Levy, which were my least favorite part of the book, because I think they were so like grotesquely accurate. You know, this is like just a poisoned relationship. And it was just like, oh my gosh, I've seen these before. I can barely be in the same room with couples like this. You know, like, take some action, change your life in the relationship, do something. But like, the poison spill out is just too much. So I think, yeah, Levy was a foil in the relationship with his wife. I just don't think he was prominent enough to be a foil for Ignatius.
Yeah, I agree with that. I think that's true. He's definitely the most sympathetic character in his weird little storyline. But I agree. It was I thought that section needed some editing.
I agree.
It was too repetitive and it became like really painful and it lost all of its humor.
Yeah.
So Krista says, she asked the question with the Levies too, and she said, I'm curious why we had to be so involved in their marriage if their only purpose was for Ignatius' character to be more fully exposed. I assume there's more to them than that. In the end, Mr. Levies and maybe Ignatius' mom character flowered by seeing the error of his ways and repenting of sorts. So can you piece this storyline together within the context of the book for me? So the question of why we had to be so involved in their marriage, do you think it's as simple as, like, even if we accept your premise that it needed some editing, why does John Kennedy Toole ask us to get to know their marriage so much, given that this is a book that's primarily about Ignatius? Like, do you have any further thoughts on this?
I kind of think that in a way, they are kind of like Jones. They're part of the set. They're part of that world. And of course, they help move the plot line forward. They're funny in their way, if you can kind of get over like the poisonous like arrows that they're hurling back and forth at each other. They move the plot forward. You know, Levy pants where the uprising is stirred by Ignatius, and it's really funny. And there's kind of like, he helps dole out the awards at the end of the book. You know, all those things sort of make sense. Mm-hmm. But I think Chris's question is a good one, because I think they're too much in the book. They need to be cut back.
They also add, just to your point about them being kind of like a set piece, if we're looking at like multiple strata of New Orleans society, they are wealthy, and but just as, I really like the word you used, Tim, just as grotesque as anybody else, even in inhabiting the upper sphere of society. So we need to have kind of that balanced look at the dysfunction within multiple levels of this particular culture. And they are just as like tawdry and sordid and grotesque as anybody else on the lower social status, even being as up high as they are. And so I do think that's necessary. Otherwise, it just...
It could become a Marxist critique. It could be
exactly
like, the lower levels of society, they are the way that they are because they're victims of the economic machinery of society.
And their place in that status is sort of just as precipitous. Like, they're on the edge. Like, a couple of bad things happen and they're no longer there anymore. You know, they're no longer in that upper class. Okay. This is an interesting question from Cindy, and she makes a note to say, I am not being confrontational. I genuinely want to learn. So she says, I'm curious to know more about why Tim and Heidi find a novel unfulfilling if a character doesn't show that they are changing and growing. What's wrong with a novel that is made up of character studies which give us people to emulate or avoid emulating? I read Confederacy of Dunces this way and was just fine with that. I wish I had a way to type my tone, she says. Like I said, she's not being confrontational. She says, most of my literary education has consisted of reading modern novels. So is it possible this is a classical education thing? Russell Henderson adds to this that, ironically, Nabokov's criticism of Dostoevsky was that his characters don't grow. So we know that you both are huge Dostoevsky fans. We can address Nabokov's claim if we want to, but...
I'm not sure that I'm going to accept the premise of Russell's statement. I've read Nabokov's criticism of Dostoevsky, and my understanding is that that's not the criticism that he levels against Dostoevsky, but Russell probably knows those essays better than I do. So I'm reluctant to say, yeah, I accept the premise of that question, because my reading of Nabokov's criticism of Dostoevsky is something different. Okay, that being out of the way, where are we?
Okay, well, let's just go back to the question of, you know, you guys talked a lot about whether the book is fulfilling, unfulfilling. So she says, why do you find a novel unfulfilling if a character doesn't show they're changing and growing? Heidi, do you want to address this first?
Sure. I think what's interesting about it, about this question, is that I love medieval literature, but out of all eras of literary output, by far the medievals have the most fixed characters in their stories. So the medievals were also known for allegorical kind of writing, right? So you have something like Spenser's Faerie Queen, and the knight is always good and chivalrous, and the villain is always wicked and evil, and the woman is always idealized and perfected. And so there's this sense of within medieval literature of kind of a fixed character representing an abstract idea or characteristic of the universe or of God or of the story of the world or whatever. And I like those. But I like them because I like the allegory, not necessarily because I'm drawn to the story as just a story. In that case, it's kind of boring. So I do think it is necessary. I mean, this goes all the way back to, as you pointed out, the classical antiquity. It was Aristotle who says a great story has a catharsis, a change in the character. And he argued that tragedy is the best genre. You know, Tim, you made the case earlier. You defended the case that comedy is, or you brought forward this right. essay that you had read. But Aristotle argues that tragedy is the greatest genre because you have a tragic character at the center of a story, of the best story, who experiences some kind of catharsis, which is a kind of a shedding of pity and fear on the part of the story that releases emotion for the audience. And I think that there's something about what Aristotle is saying. And every great author and literary critic has had to wrestle and reckon with Aristotle at some point in their writing career. Because this idea of a release of emotion, that's what a story is it builds something up. It gives us a problem or a conflict. And then that there has to be some kind of change that takes the stories from that high emotional pitch and releases it in some way. And one of the ways of doing that is to bring a change on the part of a character. The character is making mistakes, or the character is trapped in some kind of problem. And then there has to be a release of that in order for the story to end. Otherwise, it just stays at that same high emotional pitch and it never is resolved. And so that was Aristotle's case. And I'm going to say that's probably my case for wanting to see some kind of interior movement on the part of a character. That doesn't mean I want a neat little bow at the end, as I've tried to defend a million times on the show. I'm not saying I want some kind of like moral climax the way I think about morality. What I'm saying is there has to be some kind of release of the tension of the story and resolution of the problem of the story. And I think one of the best ways of doing that is within the character as well as within the character's circumstances.
That was unbelievably good. That was so good.
Thanks.
Fire.
Can you add to that?
That was fire. No, I have like how, by adding to it, I would diminish it. That was great.
Well, fine. I won't say anything then.
I'm sorry. By me adding to it, I would diminish it.
I just want to add compliment. The release of tension thing is really good because like that's at the end of the book. Like the tension needs to build. And this is true. This is like a crime novel or something, or an action story or something,
right,
is the obvious version of this. But like when you read Jane Eyre, for example, we did that earlier, or you read Hamlet or even a Much Ado About Nothing, which is a comedy, there's like this tension that hangs over. The easiest form of tension is what's going to like end up happening to these people who are in a bit hard situation. But like if a book doesn't build you up to some kind of tension, like then in the end, are you going to care about it? You're not going to care right. about how it ends. And that release of tension then eventually coming like to bear in the climax of the story is like that point was I'm not ruining it, but was, as Tim said, Tim told me I was going to ruin it, but but the idea of a release of tension being crucial to a story being worth sticking with and being memorable, like in terms of how we experience it. You know, like the emotional experience we have with the story is tied to the degree and mode of tension that the story offers to us. Mm. I don't think like it can still be a good book. It can still be a memorable book or a book that you think about or you talk about or intellectually you process, but how we emotionally experience a book or any kind of story is tied to the kind of tension that the book wraps us up in. So the way you put that was just help me kind of think about that. And then I had to think about it while speaking out loud and ruining what you said.
Well, and I just want to say when last week you asked a really good question, David, that I don't feel like I answer very well, which is what do you mean when you say satisfying? And that's what I mean. I'm using it. I'm hoping I'm using it in as objective a sense as possible in the sense of it is satisfying to experience a catharsis in a story. And that feels to me objective, not subjective. I'm not saying when I say satisfying, I'm not saying I want the book to end the way I want it to end.
Right.
Personally, yeah. Satisfying. What I'm saying mm-hmm. is, does it satisfactorily create and resolve the tension? And does the ending of the book then bring as much kind of release as it brought buildup? And in a way that is surprising, but also satisfying. Mm. And that I mean it in an objective sense, because I think that there's an objectivity in our soul's need of that. Mm.
I feel like this point is really important, not just to you, Heidi, but to all of us, because one thing that is kind of like crucial to this show is we're determined to let books speak and define their own world. Like Heidi is very keen, and I so appreciate it because I am 100% with her to not impose like her set of convictions upon the book and say, this book succeeds if it conforms to my standards, my proclivities,
or
my
Christian
beliefs,
worldview or whatever.
My Christian worldview or something like that. Yeah. Like you've always been really clear, and hopefully we've all been really clear that that's not like loving your neighbor. It's not loving the author. It's not being benevolent as a reader. And so I really appreciate the kind of distinction that you're making, because it could sound to someone who doesn't know you and who hasn't paid attention to this show very much that you're somehow advocating for this book didn't really fit my like view of the world and thus I don't like it. No, it's a lot more sophisticated than that. A lot more sophisticated than that.
Yeah,
just generally speaking,
it's not even
true
in the same vein. To say to call it more like sophisticated is not right. It's just a different. You like interpret books in a very different way than someone who would say it needs to conform to my vision of the world.
Well, I appreciate that. I do think that it is worth kind of, as you said, repeating that over and over and over again as we read on the show for, yeah. You know, for listeners who are like, well, I know. Like, but I agree. I think it's easy to sound morally simplistic, especially yeah. with my response to this particular book, because I just thought it was gross and I didn't like that. But I understand yeah. it's like, that's a preference issue and very separate from the objective quality of the novel, which I freely accept.
Mm. Yeah.
The tension thing is so interesting because that is one of those things where it can be so unique to each individual, so mm-hmm. personal in terms of what kind of things lead us to feel tension. And yet so many of the greatest books make all people feel tension if they're paying attention in the particular moments, right? Like who doesn't feel some sort of tension if you're actually reading Hamlet mm. in the moments where Shakespeare wants you to feel tension, regardless of what your typical personal taste is. And so it's funny, like when I'm working on some kind of writing, that question of tension, even if I wouldn't put it this way, is like, I think it drives so much of a creator's, of a writer's time, because you're wanting to hold the attention and create tension in some way in almost every scene, right? Like when Tim's writing a play, you want each scene to build on the previous scene and build up the tension of the story, and yet each have its own compelling sort of tension within the moment. And like, even if we don't think about it that way, it's such a challenge to storytelling that when you see something be universally accepted as tense, just to use the terms of the story, it's like, wow, like it just blows my mind that everybody feels tension in the moment.
Yeah.
When Hamlet is going through this thing, even if they wouldn't like people with completely different personalities, completely different tastes, right. If they're paying attention, we all feel tension in this moment. And yeah. Like, that's one of the markers of like universally something becoming universally capital G capital B great book. Mm-hmm. And it's like so hard to accomplish,
And by the way, just as an advocate for my own, like my own genre,
plays.
That's the thing that I love about theater is that if theater does its job, we are feeling as a group, a bunch of total strangers sitting next mm-hmm. to each other. We, mm-hmm. and coming from radically different places. If the actors and the script and the director and the producer have all done well, we are all experiencing the same thing at the same time. Like those, that kind of like feeling of a group emotion is so powerful. It's so democratic in a way that I really enjoy and value. It's so human, kind of capital H human. And I think we get the same thing with books. We certainly do. But yeah. What Heidi experiences is experienced in isolation. What David experiences is experienced in isolation. And then when we get together on this show, we oftentimes can talk about, oh yeah, I felt the same way when I read this passage or that passage. And so it's a little bit of a kind of like a theatrical production that we are putting on here, but
it's individual, but also universal at the same time. We'll be each of our own particular feeling, but we feel it at the same times.
Yeah.
And I think the only way that can happen is if you have like these great books that we're talking about, they accomplish this, like that's just Hamlet. The two things that make that possible is a real insight into the human psyche and like into the world, which the great books, the greatest books have, the greatest authors have, but also the ability to create a consistency within the world itself. Because if the world that you're experiencing as a reader isn't true to itself, isn't consistent, doesn't have its own patterns that we can all recognize, which we talk about all the time, right? That we want to let the book be what it is. If you don't have that, then that tension is not going to be there. And then you have to have those two things together. And I think that's why it's almost impossible, because if you lose one thread of that consistency, then that tension starts to become particular and not universal.
Yeah.
Right.
It's so difficult. Hey, one last question here. We got one more question here about the writing. This is from Sarah Curry. She says, Tool is obviously a master at crafting sentences. His word choices usually seem exact and perfectly planned. Yet he uses the word screamed a lot. Everyone is screaming at each other in many instances when it seems the dialogue could have been said with the same vitriol without the volume. Is that a flaw, or do you think it was intentional? To me, it was distracting and even stressful, but perhaps that was the point. She says, I never so passionately loved a book while at the same time not caring to pick it up between readings. It was confusing. A strong meh while on my nightstand with an equally strong perfection while in my hands.
Wow, that was beautiful.
Totally true.
I felt that. Big time.
Me too. Same.
So what do we think about the way he writes these sentences? I mean, he says
particularly screamed. The word screamed.
Yeah. Like, I think she's using that as an example of the way he writes.
I picked up on that. There was a few times I thought, wait, Ignatius just screamed? That doesn't seem to fit the vocabulary that he just used. And I kind of took that as a statement more about, heightened feelings from the speaker more than an actual high-pitched, loud, resonant utterance.
That was so great. A high-pitched, loud, resonant utterance. He just defined
the word scream.
I'm just going to look this up.
No, I did. I totally.
On dictionary.com. Did you just look it up? Because I feel like that's what it says.
Am I alone in this? Like, I totally agree. That is what
a scream is
something that is leaving your body and going out in the world. And I interpreted it as a statement of inner feeling. So I completely acknowledge, like, I did some hermeneutical gymnastics there. Because
saying that John Kennedy Toole is expressing something about the character rather than the action.
I think so. I'm not meaning to say like, oh, Ignatius might have whispered that sentence. I don't think that. I think it came out, you know, big, but I think it was more a statement about how Ignatius was kind of like, he was internally roiled when he said it.
Hmm. I really, really like what Sarah said, that it was distracting and somewhat stressful, but maybe that's the point, because that's how I interpreted it. I find screaming in general very stressful. And anytime it would appear on the page, I would, like, my emotional response to that dialogue changed completely. Whenever he said screamed or slobbered, which was another word he used a lot to describe Ignatius when he was talking. And as soon as I saw that word on the page, I like internally got like stressed out. And I think that that is a part of why I found this book stressful to read. I like this book way better now that I'm not reading it anymore. Now that I'm just thinking about it.
Yeah. I just want to restate this. Sarah asked, like, the word scream, you know, kind of like, how'd you read it? Any normal reader would say scream. It's about like the volume and the pitch of the utterance. Tim said it's about the internal, like, combustion that's happening within the character. Right. And Heidi said, it's about me.
Yeah.
It's about me.
Like, but I didn't like it. I just, like Sarah, I was like, oh, now I'm reading about people screaming at each other. And then I'm like not thinking about the words. I'm just like waiting for the scene to be over.
Yeah.
And I do think that's the point. I think that's why he uses these emotionally loaded words in the dialogue. And that's why my favorite part of the book, like, I usually like dialogue a lot. I didn't like reading the dialogue in this book hardly at all, except when Miss Trixie was saying Gloria, in which case I laughed my head off. But the parts I liked were the parts when, what mostly like Ignatius's written words, those were my favorite parts of the book. Cause I thought they were funny. But like anytime there's two people talking or in a conflict, I was stressed out because the words like screamed and slobbered. So I think that those dialogue markers are really important interpretive keys in the book, and they add so, so much to the emotional pitch because they create a strong response in the reader, which is why it's about me.
Well, I mean, that's true though, because every read you're trying to create, you know, a storyteller is trying to create emotional response. Like, you're trying to create an individual experience that each reader is going to have. Like, you're trying to create something universal and also a particular experience. And any writer that doesn't pay attention to the fact that every person who reads their story or watches their movie or attends their play is going to have a particular experience with it is being an idiot. Not to put too fine a point on it, but also when you read Woodhouse next time, watch the number of the way he talks about people walking, because he never says that somebody walks. He uses every possible other word, including a lot of words that don't exist and aren't actually about walking.
Advanced. Yes, he does.
Right. I think it's the Woodhouse of it all here in the Confederacy of Dunces. Okay. We are out of time. Final thoughts on this book. Heidi, you first, then Tim. And then we're going to go our merry way in varying degrees of merry.
Uh-huh. I think I'm going to close with, I have a very dissonant experience with this book. On the one hand, it's hilarious and I liked that. On the other hand, I found it distasteful. But on the third hand, because I have three hands now, I'm thinking about it a lot after reading it. And so this is not a great book, capital G, capital B, in terms of the technical definition of great book as like influential in culture and enduring over generations. However, I am going to say my final word on the book is this is a really great novel, and there's flaws in it and it could have been better. But man, if you could actively dislike a book and can't wait to be done with it, but then once you're done with it, you can't stop thinking about it. It's good. And this is the first book I've ever read on the show that I just did not like. And I am the first one. I hope it's the only one, but I'm so glad I read it. And I'm going to say, like, this is a really good novel. And this is why people should read things they don't like, stick through it to the end, and be charitable toward it. Period.
I think I just enjoyed the book more than you did, Heidi. I think I just found it easier to laugh at and kind of bracket the kind of grotesque parts of it. I just think I found that a little bit more easy to do. Maybe because I lived on an all guys dorm in college and really recognize a lot of the actions of Ignatius J. Reilly as the actions of myself and our tribe. I felt the same way that you did. Like, the book pings around in my head after I'm done with it. And I always consider that a primary marker of a really, really good book. The books that I can walk away from and never think about, you know, 5 minutes after I put the book down, no, they just don't meet the qualifications for me of like just being of excellence. And I think that this book meets that first basic criteria of excellence.
Well, thank you for answering some questions and for your great conversation.
David, what are
on this
your
book.
Final thoughts?
I don't know. You read P.G. Woodhouse? I don't know.
Always a good final thought.
I'm just going to make that my sign off for every episode now. Read P.G. Woodhouse. I like this book. I feel some of the complaints that people have or the difficulties that people have with it. But I'm glad we read it, and I'm glad that, you know, we were able to talk about it together. And it is a book that kind of like lingers, kind of hangs around. You'll probably be thinking about it, and something's going to pop up in 10 years when you're reading something else. So I'm thanks to everybody who didn't love it, but pushed through and read with us. And, you know, reading as a community, as a group is super, super fun and really special. So we're going to do that one more time this year. We're going to talk about Henry Green's Loving. We're going to do the one episode. It's a relatively short novel, another weird one. Heidi, do you like Loving better than you like this?
Yeah, I like Loving. Okay. It's a really weird book, but I like it.
So yeah, we're ending 2021. We're ending a weird year with some weird books. And then of course, as we begin the new year, we're going to dive into Agatha Christie's Death on the Nile. That movie is coming out in February. Next week, we'll do some, sometime soon, we'll be posting some episodes on our favorite books that we read this last year. And we also, of course, have The Daily Poem. We've got Withy Windle season 2 just wrapped up of that. So if you haven't, you know, if you and your families haven't caught up with that, you can check out all our interviews with the authors and the great times that we had on that show. Of course, there is the plays The Thing, which is in, you guys are doing Henry IV right now. Act 1 is up. Act 2 should be up soon, I believe. And we've got our Patreon episodes. We're in the middle of Anna Karenina, getting towards the middle of that very long book. So hopefully everybody's, you know, if you're a Patreon supporter, first of all, thank you so much. And hopefully you're loving those conversations. And we all know how much Tim and Heidi adore that book. So, and Brandon adores that book as well. And I'm on it in a hit or miss fashion on those episodes, but I also really like that book. So hopefully our affection for that book is shining through on those episodes. Just want to say Merry Christmas to everybody. Thank you so much for a great year, for supporting Close Reads, whether it's Patreon, Facebook group, telling friends, leaving reviews, whatever you've done, you know, just listening and being a part of this community is awesome. We're grateful to be able to share our love of books with you, to have these conversations with you. And thank you for giving us the opportunity to get together once a week and nerd out a little bit about the books that we love, the things that we love about literature. You are giving us the opportunity to do something we love, and hopefully we are returning the favor and giving you content that you love. So I just wanted to add that here at the end. It's been a weird year in many ways, but the Close Reads community is like a constant. You know, every week we get to come and do a show for you guys. We're really thankful for that. So I don't know if Tim or Heidi, you want to add anything on to what I'm saying here, but feel free if you do.
Tim, do you feel comfortable expressing any kind of positive emotion at this time of year?
Despite my objections to festive feelings at this time of year. That's actually, we've made like a joke of it. This is not even true.
Tim's a festive
guy. I don't feel this way. Like, I get to see my brother and sister-in-law tomorrow. I am ecstatic. I'm so happy. And I know it only happens thanks to this beautiful time of year. But I just want to echo everything that David said. We are really fortunate to be able to do what we do. Heidi, stop glaring at me.
I know. In spite of the fact that Tim doesn't love baby Jesus, we're going to... It's so...
I don't even know what to say.
You came after our matching Christmas pajamas. We
talk about how I'm like a little brother on this show to you all, but Heidi is in straight up like
little sister mode.
Little sister.
She's coming after me. I am going to, you know what I am doing? I am memorizing a new hymn with my friend Ben as a way of like honoring the season.
I'm so glad to
honoring
hear that.
Baby Jesus.
This is so, yes.
Yes.
Who
yes.
he does love, Heidi.
Yes. He in turn is memorizing a Shakespeare monologue about the fear of death. It just feels like it's so on brand.
It's really, that so is definitely
you may want to
on
stop
brand.
Yes. Yeah, I'll walk back.
The fear of death, right? I'll walk back. Since I do love baby Jesus and happiness, I just really love you guys. I love you guys. I love the two of you. I don't mess with people unless I love them, Tim McIntosh. And yeah, Merry Christmas and God bless us, everyone, which I know.
Everyone.
Everyone. That's right.
Well, with that, for Heidi White and for Tim McIntosh, I'm David Kern. Thank you so much for listening. And until next time. Happy reading.
Bah humbug. What?
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.